Chavez against Perryman is our fourth case of this morning. Mr. Camelli.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Taher Camelli. I'm one of the attorneys for the petition, in this case, Ruben Gomez-Chavez. Your Honor, the facts of this case is very simple. January of 1999, petitioner was ordered excluded from the United States by one of the INS field agents. March of 99, petitioner was married to a United States citizen in the United States.
After he slipped back into the country in violation of the order that he signed, right?
That is correct, sir.
Right. So he knew that he had done something that violated the condition of his, well, the result of his January 30, 1999 exclusion.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it's of some relevance that he was in the country illegally.
Yes.
Or he wouldn't be here, right?
That is true.
Yeah.
In May of 1999, petitioner and his wife filed for applications to adjust his status to a lawful permanent resident because he was permitted by the law of the United States to do so. The respondent in July of 18, 2001, invited the petitioner for an interview in the respondent's office. At that time, one of the agents of the respondent ordered the petitioner deported from the United States by reinstating the exclusion order that was issued in January of 1999. Now, at that time, no INS judge, no immigration judge, no federal judge, Board of Immigration Appeals, nobody had ordered him deported.
But now, the problem I think I see with your position is this. The first time he's required, as it were, to leave the country, the January 30th event, is a determination of inadmissibility. He wasn't legally here and then, as the old saying was, the old term, deported. He was not allowed in. So those procedures are not procedures that trigger an immigration judge and the Bureau of Immigration Appeals and all the rest of it. If you're not even going to come in, you are simply, I guess he was at DFW Airport, turned around and put in the next plane back out again. Not only that, there are issues about collateral attack on that event. Then the later event occurs under this new statute, which had been in place for some time when it happened to him, that allows the Attorney General to reinstate that order. And why do you think you get a new hearing on the reinstatement of the order?
Judge, in 1996, the Congress of the United States, by enacting IRA-IRA, basically got rid of exclusion or deportation. There's
right.
only one word right now, it's called removal.
But there's a distinction in the case law between refusal to admit somebody, an entry decision, and a requirement that someone leave. Now, maybe that's a very fine distinction, but it's a very firm one in the law.
Absolutely. The INS has the right to stop him, to exclude him from the United States. In some circumstances, when there's a question about asylum, about a refugee status, they must be reported to the INS, to an immigration judge. They have to be reported to an immigration judge. In this case, it has been our argument, since we started this case in district court, that since he is in the United States right now, the Fifth Amendment protection of due process of law applies to him, Your Honor.
But due process doesn't prohibit enforcement of judgment. It doesn't say every time you want to enforce a judgment, you have to start from scratch and relitigate the case. And I think that's part of what the government's argument is, a big part of it.
Absolutely. The judgment is usually issued by a judge.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, the earlier, he is not and cannot attack the earlier determination that he was in the United States or trying to get into the United States unlawfully. I would think that the only things you could complain about are addressable by the system that the INS is proposing, in that if the Attorney General had made a mistake, you know, that this isn't the Mr. Gomez-Chavez that we excluded earlier, he could present that on an appeal from this new order requiring him to leave if they're wrong about the illegality of his existence in the United States, some other bureaucrat in the INS actually gave him permission to enter and somebody lost the piece of paper. Again, that would be a matter that would be raisable on an appeal from this later exclusion order.
Could I ask you concretely whether you plan to make any of the, if there's a hearing, whether you plan to make any of the arguments Judge Wood mentioned? That is, that this is a case of misidentification, or that your client is, in fact, a citizen, or that he had lawful permission to reenter the United States?
What we are planning to do is there is a hearing to ask the immigration judge, based on the waiver that has been filed on July 25th, asking the immigration to waive his excludability, waive his deportability.
So in other words, no.
The answer is no. You don't plan to make any of the arguments that would be legal defenses.
As they are set forth in the regulation, in the ACFR.
Yeah, then I don't understand what a hearing would do. And it's like saying, I want to avoid summary judgment in some case, not because I have any legal entitlement to avoid summary judgment, but I want to argue for jury nullification. And so you should not grant summary judgment and let me have a jury. But that does not entitle one to a hearing.
Your Honor, by the 8 U.S.C. 1231A5 has made INS have given them power to be the defendant in this case, to be the judge in this case, to be the police in this case.
Well, but they're the agency in this case, is the way I would look at it. And the fact is, if there's an appeal to the Court of Appeals from the agency action, whether the actor within the agency is an immigration officer, whether it's an immigration judge, whether it's the Bureau, I'm not sure it's a question of constitutional significance. The agency has a process, somehow or another, it comes up with final agency action. And then, for me anyway, it's a very important aspect of this that there be some way to test the legality of that to prevent utterly arbitrary or unconstitutional results. But again, as the INS is suggesting this all ought to be done, that wouldn't be the result. You would have an opportunity to raise things that are cognizable under this new statute in the court.
Now, Judge, the only thing that you can do based on the regulation and INS argument in this case is just to argue with the INS again. Again, they do not send...
No, you can tell the court you got the wrong man. I mean, you can. There are a very narrow set of things, but otherwise what Congress wanted was, as it were, enforcement of earlier exclusion orders. They didn't want people to keep slipping across in El Paso and coming back in after they've been told not to.
So it's the question of the review by this court or by any other court is a question mark, because 1252 does not say anything about the exclusion orders or these kind of orders that have been issued by the INS to be appealed to this court.
But do you want to argue against it, or would you argue in principle that there should be review to this court?
There should be a review in a court.
Right.
Mr. Camilli, if I may invite your attention to the other document that's involved here, the application for permission to reapply for admission to the United States.
Yes, sir.
That's a separate document, is it not?
That is true, sir.
Now, when was that filed?
July 25th, 2001.
Now, is this before or after his interview and arrest by the INS?
It was after his interview, before his arrest, Judge. July 18th, the interview was done. He was detained shortly. He was released on July 19th.
Yes.
The waiver application that you were indicating was filed on July 25th. And on August 2nd, again, the INS detained him.
Okay. Now, with respect to this application, is there a copy of it in the record?
It has been provided in the district level. It was provided this.
Now, in that, on that form, there's a place where you have to give the reason why you want to, you want the Attorney General to waive, or rather, to grant you permission to re-enter the country despite having been removed. What reason did he give?
Judge, the reason I believe that was provided for the approval of an I-130. I-130 is a petition that is originally, that is filed by a wife who is a U.S. citizen,
yes,
to get green card, right, or permanent residency, mm-hmm, for the spouse. That application, the I-130, was approved actually by the INS on July 19, 2001. And in the bottom of the I-90, of the I-130 approval, it indicates that we're going to wait for adjudication of I-130 until you go see an immigration judge. But they never sent him to an immigration judge.
Okay, now, I know this isn't your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if, in fact, your client is removed and for having re-entered the United States without permission after having been removed, his application for change of status, because of the change in his marital status, in effect becomes moot, does it not?
It would become moot, yes, sir.
If you, would that not then also make this separate document, this permission to apply for admission to the United States, moot, since it gave as its reason his change of marital status?
In reality, with all due respect, Judge, no, it would not. When an I-130 is approved, the petitioner can either file for adjustment of status within the country or can proceed with the consular proceedings. Now, if he is removed from the United States, the I-130 will be adjudicated in the U.S. consulate in Mexico. However, he will not be allowed to come back to the United States for a period of 10 years. Why? Because he has been in the country for 1 year illegally. That's another part of the law that was passed in 1996. So the waiver application would stand. Either way, he has to, if he's in the country, he has to have the permission of the government to adjudicate his I-485, which is the adjustment of status in the country. If he's outside the U.S., he has to get the waiver.
In effect, you have asked that we order the Attorney General to act on this application for permission to apply for admission to the United States.
That has been one of our requests when I filed a writ of mandate.
But if this is processes to begin, in effect, de novo in a consulate in Mexico, isn't this request for us to order the Attorney General to act on that application at best premature?
Judge, if the waiver is issued here, if the waiver is accepted by the INS, by the District Director, by Attorney General in Chicago, then that waiver can be transferred to the consulate in Mexico and the proceeding can take place.
I see. Could you clarify then for me why Section 1252G would not prevent our adjudication of your request that we order the Attorney General to act on this? That section does say we have no jurisdiction with respect to the Attorney General's decisions to adjudicate cases. Isn't that basically what you're asking us to do?
Judge, the adjudication, the writ of mandamus, or the order asking the Attorney General to do something, the adjudication of the application was not one of the part of the three arguments, three things that a 1252G prevented this court or any other court to do.
Can you point me to any authority on that? I mean, the plain language of the statute would seem to say that 1252G is a limitation on the general authority of district courts to mandamus, a government officer to act with on those matters over which he has a duty to act.
Yes, sir. In our brief, we have mentioned, I believe, two authorities from courts. I believe in the ninth. Brief, we have mentioned about two authorities, I believe, which were, I think, from the Ninth Circuit, if I'm not mistaken, that explicitly have indicated that the writ of mandamus or something about the adjudication of a 485 or something called like waiver application is not part of the 1252G. It doesn't prevent the courts to ask the Attorney General to do something. I believe my time is up with the permission I have.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Sander.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Pastor Sandu on behalf of the Appellees. Your Honor, I think one crucial point at the outset to note in this case is, as Your Honors have mentioned, is that there is no issue in this case or dispute that the plaintiff in the case is someone who was previously excluded from the country and has unlawfully reentered the United States and therefore falls within the plain terms of the reinstatement statute. And therefore, he cannot demonstrate any prejudice on the merits of his claim. Now, before I go more specifically into the merits claim, I'd like to talk about jurisdiction and make a couple of points to clarify that issue, because this case and these proceedings, I do think, present a unique situation. It is the government's position, as per the statute, that reinstatement removal orders, like removal orders in general, can be heard in the Court of Appeals on a timely filed petition for review within 30 days from the date of the reinstatement. Every circuit that has addressed this question has reached this conclusion. So we would ask this court to find that the district court lacked jurisdiction over the habeas, or actually it was a complaint that was filed in this case, and to find that the district court lacked jurisdiction in that regard. Now, in our briefs, we do suggest that given the unique circumstances, the court perhaps may want to transfer this case up to itself, as the Ninth Circuit indicated in a couple of decisions that it has recently set out in Castro-Cortez and Gallo.
Why? What purpose would it serve? If your adversary had said that he wanted to make any of the kinds of arguments that might allow an attack, then that might make sense. But it doesn't. He said he didn't want to make any of those arguments.
No,
so what would be the point?
I agree, Your Honor. I think what I was about to proceed to say is, looking at the merits of this claim, there's no substantial claim on the merits, and therefore the court can just go ahead and affirm the district court's dismissal.
But isn't there, as you're very tactfully implying, this case was procedurally mixed up, shall I say, for a period of time, and there may be some purpose in this circuit taking one side or the other anyway on the issue that the other circuits have addressed about how one handles these reinstatement statutes, even if it's just to say, now it's here, and are there any arguments that are cognizable? We don't see any. There are plenty of these appeals.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I guess, I was going to proceed on this point as well. I think the first point is to clear up some of the confusion in the district courts, as well as among the aliens over the statute. I think the court should definitely, in its decision, lay out exactly what the procedure for judicial review is. And we do concede that review is available directly by petition for review in the Court of Appeals on these critical factors, at least the alienage, whether there was a lawful entry, and whether there was a proper, or whether there was a deportation previously.
And I take it your position on the statute that Judge Ripple mentioned is rests on the except as otherwise provided language that we looked at in Laguerre and that we've looked at in other cases in the context of non-reinstatement proceedings, regular exclusion proceedings, right?
That
we can review the order for that set of things that are open to us.
That's precisely correct, and that except as provided language would then allow the limited avenue of review through a petition for review in the Court of Appeals. That's what it's referring to, Section 1242. Let me say a couple of things about Judge Ripple's questions on the adjustment application. First of all, we think that 242G would bar any mandamus jurisdiction as well, because of the fact of what Judge Ripple precisely mentioned, the adjudicate cases language. This is a case.
What do you say to your colleague's remark that the Ninth Circuit's ruled otherwise? Have they, in fact?
The Ninth Circuit hasn't, Your Honor. And what he may be referring to is some district court cases which say that adjudication of adjustment applications is outside of the deportation context. But those are cases, I think, where you'll find where proceedings have not commenced. So it's a closer question here. Immigration proceedings have commenced. What he's now trying to do, as we lay out in his brief, is he's trying to compel the Attorney General to adjudicate an application for relief in the face of or interfering with the proceedings.
In violation of a statute, which says
and
that
in violation
no relief
of
is available.
And my next point would have been plainly in violation
of
statute.
That's 1231A5.
That's right. And so there's another problem here, because there's no duty to adjudicate the case. The plaintiff is ineligible.
There's a prohibition on adjudicating the case.
Your Honor, getting back to Your Honor's question with regard to a decision that would be helpful not only on jurisdiction, but I think you're right in the sense of addressing this statute. I know we have a number of cases in district court and perhaps before this court on this new provision. So we would ask this court that it would clarify the jurisdictional issue, make a finding that the district court didn't have jurisdiction, and if it so chooses to specifically point out...
Is there more cases pending on this reinstatement provision?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if any before...
Well, I'm a little surprised, actually, that this case is here, since reentering the United States after a removal order is a felony. I mean, why is this man not in prison?
Well, I'm not sure I have the entirely accurate question, but there is discretion on whether or not to prosecute, obviously, and
I understand we're in the United States rather than Germany.
And in a lot of cases, they don't prosecute these reentry issues just because there's workload burden. They may, in the exercise of discretion, decide that they want to go ahead and remove the individual, allow the INS to remove the individual.
Well, I take it, right, especially in a case like this where there's something else complicating it, like, you know, felony or anything like that, the Attorney General just has a choice of actions he can take.
That's right. There may be looking at the equities of the situation as well. Let me also mention one other thing, and that was the discussion about, as I think the plaintiff's counsel correctly described, the process that this petitioner or this plaintiff would have available to him outside the country. I mean, he can go to the consular embassy, and he's got an approved visa petition. He can apply for waivers. There is a bar, it is true, for reentry out following deportation and for unlawful presence. But I would point the court to the available waiver that can be applied for from abroad at 8 U.S.C. section 1182A9, big B, Roman numeral 5V, which is a waiver of the unlawful presence requirement. That can be.
I'm sorry, could you read the statute again? After about four subsections, I tend to get lost.
Sure, Your Honor. I believe it's in our briefs as well. 8 U.S.C. 1182, small a, 9, big B, Roman numeral 5.
Okay.
And does that allow a waiver of the 10 years, or does he have to wait the 10 years no matter what?
That I believe that particular provision allows him to apply to reenter, notwithstanding the 10-year bar. But he'd have to get the permission of the Attorney General to do so.
But there is some power. You're telling me that there is some power for the Attorney General to mitigate that 10-year.
Under that bar that he had mentioned, which is at 1182A9B, there is a subsection, Roman numeral 5, which provides a way of that. In conclusion,
we'll look it up. It's hard to follow.
Okay. If there are no more questions, Your Honor, in conclusion, we ask that this court would affirm the district court's dismissal of the complaint in this case.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Camelli. The case is taken under advisement.